The contents of the lab report are meant for educational purposes only and are not meant to be misconstrued as medical diagnosis or treatment advice. Today on the lab report, Dr. Nathan Jenkins.
Yeah, we're going to geek out over biochemistry and exercise physiology.
Did you know he was an Olympic weightlifter?
I did.
No.
The world of medicine can be challenging. Clinicians and patients are always looking for more options, more effective treatments, and in the end, more answers. Functional and integrative medicine focuses on addressing root causes of disease. Here at Genova Diagnostics, we've watched this field evolve and grow for over 35 years. We've not only adapted, we've led. Join us as we talk about functional medicine, laboratory testing, and optimizing health. Welcome to the Lab Report.
Do you like reality shows?
Some of them.
What's your favorite?
Probably Survivor. I think it's a microcosm of life. What's yours?
It's that Alone show,
but
I also like Project Runway. Hello!
Hi, Michael Chapman. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Patty Devers?
I'm crushing it today.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Well done.
Thanks.
Hey, everyone. This is a podcast. Did you know? Or did you just hit the wrong button on your phone?
Well, either way.
Either way, thanks for being here. We're called The Lab Report, and we're happy to be talking into your ears. This is a show where we talk about functional medicine, specialty lab testing, integrative therapeutics, and so much more.
And if you hit the wrong button and ended up here, maybe go searching and see if you get back to the iTunes store, maybe subscribe to the show.
Yes.
Rate, review, leave us some feedback there.
Seemingly, you're very good at navigating your phone. If you happen to be here by choice and not accident, thank you. We love you. And feel free to share this podcast with your friends and provide feedback. Tell us what we can do better. Send it to podcast@gdx.net. Always appreciate that info.
We love it. And I will say, it's a very important week here at Genova, Michael Chapman.
Yes, it is.
It happens to be Lab Week, also known as Medical Laboratory Professionals Week.
Yes. And with that, we should certainly take a moment to step back and really give a huge thank you, round of applause to the lab individual, everyone working at the lab here at Genova Diagnostics and working at labs all across.
Yeah, the unsung heroes without whom you wouldn't have the information in which to help your patients optimize their health.
Yeah, so whether you work in chemistry or molecular or microbiology, immunology,
R&D,
or any of the departments that help support the lab in any way, just want to say thank you so much for everything that you do.
And you know, today we have a very special guest on.
We sure do.
Dr. Nathan Jenkins, who also happens to be the director of a laboratory.
Yes.
Does some really important research in metabolic flexibility and biochemistry and exercise science.
And you know, we are all about the intersection of biochemistry, metabolic flexibility,
we love it,
and science.
Mm.
So I think we are going to have an awesome conversation. I'm pumped
to
talk to this professor and ask him a lot of questions that, I don't know, maybe it'll be helpful for you.
Well, by all means, let's call Dr. Nathan Jenkins.
So, Patty.
Yeah.
Today, we are speaking with Dr. Nathan Jenkins.
Oh, I know. I'm excited.
Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Nathan Jenkins. Professor Nathan Jenkins earned his undergraduate and master's degree in exercise science from the University of Georgia, UGA.
Mm-hmm.
He completed his PhD and postdoctoral training at the University of Maryland and University of Missouri in exercise physiology and vascular biology. Dr. Jenkins is a CrossFit athlete and former Olympic weightlifter.
Whoa.
Currently, he is tenured professor of exercise physiology at UGA and director of the Integrative Cardiovascular Physiology Laboratory. He conducts research and teaches courses on exercise, obesity, and cardiometabolic disease. As an integrative exercise physiologist, his primary research interests are in determining the impact of acute and chronic exercise on cardiovascular and metabolic health. And to date, Dr. Jenkins has published over 80 articles in the academic literature, which collectively have been cited thousands of times. And so with that,
welcome, Dr.
Thank
Jenkins.
Thank you so much for being here.
Holy cow, I'm blushing. Thank you so much, guys. I'm excited to be here.
Cool. Well, Dr. Jenkins, you obviously have a keen interest in exercise, given your experience as a CrossFit athlete and an Olympic weightlifter. But can you maybe tell us where the interest in geeking out over the science of exercise physiology comes from? I mean, that's a pretty big leap there.
Sure. I mean, gosh, how far back do we want to go? I have always... The origins, I guess, are like in childhood. In high school, elementary, middle school, I was actually like an overweight kid. Not so much to the point of getting made fun of, but I was definitely the tubbier one of my friends. And then in high school, I I don't even really know how, but it was just something my friends were doing. We all started kind of working out at the local gym there in my hometown, Marietta, Georgia. And at the time, it was a lot of what we now refer to as kind of the bodybuilding style of working out, you know, isolated muscle groups on certain days of the week. This is like in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, kind of mm-hmm. current fitness industry at that time. Mm-hmm. And it timed well with like adolescence and all that stuff for me. So I just completely transformed physically and also got really interested, like, you know, looking back on it, probably a lot of the mental and emotional benefits as well of exercise. And then when I started out at UGA, I was looking for something to major in. This mm-hmm. is during my first year, my freshman year. And I lasted literally about 3 days as a political science major. And then I discovered that you could be an exercise science major at a large and diverse university like UGA, diverse in the academic offering sense. We have a lot of different things you could pick. Mm-hmm. And so I was searching on the internet, came across that, and it's like, okay, that sounds really neat. So long story short, as I signed up for an intro to kinesiology or intro to exercise science class, it was at the time, really got into it. And also signed up for a research practicum with my now colleague, Dr. Kevin McCulley. I'm jumping ahead a little bit in time, but this is like leading into my junior year, I did a research practicum and got really interested in this idea of a career where you could ask questions and find the answers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that is what research essentially is for me, is asking questions that no one's ever asked before, with varying degrees of practicality and application for the rest of the world to care about.
Right.
But then setting up an experiment to go and figure out the answer to that question. I just love that process. So anyway, that's the process. And then also the specific content of exercise and its acute and chronic responses. That's evolved a lot over the years, and we can talk all about that and leading up to what some of the stuff we're doing now. But generally speaking, I've transitioned more early on. I was really interested in exercise performance. Did some work on like the effects of caffeine on endurance performance. So at the time, when I started out in graduate school, I was a competitive cyclist. All of my competitive accolades and everything, very, very, very casual, including the CrossFit and Olympic weightlifting stuff. I dabble, very, very enthusiastic and recreational, but I make my money with my brain and not with my, physical prowess, I guess. So from there, transition to, mechanisms by which exercise improves health and, mitigates chronic disease. That's something I've been interested in forever. And so everything that I've done, I've kind of done a lot of different specific things in my research, but that's been the common thread, I guess, is exercise and as prevention and treatment for chronic disease.
Great.
That's awesome. I mean, let me dig into the research a little bit, especially what mm-hmm. you're working on right now. You have been talking a lot about the effects of various types of exercise and its effect on metabolic flexibility. And this concept mm-hmm. of metabolic flexibility is something that's finally moved from the research and kind of gotten out a little bit into more of the mainstream mm-hmm. functional medicine. So can you start by telling us your definition of metabolic flexibility to someone who might not be familiar with what that is?
Sure. Yeah. It's your ability to use the stuff you eat. So that's my personal, I guess, scientific, but also lay person's definition. That's the way I think about it personally, in a way that like a fifth grader can understand it, is if you eat carbohydrate, you should be able to burn that carbohydrate for fuel. If you eat fat, you should be able to burn that fat for fuel, as opposed to somebody who's metabolically inflexible. The situation metabolically or physiologically favors storage of those substrates as fat instead of using them for fuel. We're really excited about this idea that exercise can improve metabolic flexibility, that is, improve the body's ability to burn the food that's put into it, the carbohydrates and the fat.
Well, then how do you measure metabolic flexibility in your lab? Like, how is that something mm-hmm. you can measure?
Well, we use a technique to get into the technical aspects a little bit. It's kind of hard to talk about it without too much of that. And forgive me, I'm not super familiar with your target audience here. So if I need to change the level at which I pitch some of these answers, please just, you know, coach me up on that. But we use a technique known as indirect calorimetry, which basically analyzes expired gases for oxygen and carbon dioxide and nitrogen content. And we're using that information, we can calculate the resting metabolic rate, as well as the what we call the substrate partitioning. So how much of the various energy that's being consumed is partitioned to fat or versus carbohydrate. So, using that technology under different conditions, we can get an insight into somebody's metabolic profile, aka their metabolic flexibility. And so the way it works, there's different specific ways to do it, but for like a resting metabolic measurement, which is where we tend to study metabolic flexibility, that you can imagine, it looks like some sort of spaceship, like a space helmet kind of thing that you fit over the person's head as they're lying supine on a hospital bed. Mm-hmm. And they just lay there and rest and breathe normally. And we measure their expired gases and look at the metabolism. So
cool.
Is that we also go ahead.
I was just gonna say, is that an improvement of, like, it used to be like a room that you would put someone in? Mm-hmm. Right? Is this the same sort of idea, or?
It's the same idea. It's not an improvement. It's that's because that, so that would be a direct calorimeter, calorimetry assessment. So a room calorimeter is kind of the gold standard, and there's only, I don't know how many there are of these in the country, but you know, less than 10, mm-hmm. 5 to 10, I would say, labs that are set up for that.
Oh.
And that's awesome. I've never even been to one or seen one. Mm-hmm. I think there's one in Boston, and anyway, there's a few around. This is an indirect calorimeter, which basically it's the same concept though. It's mm-hmm. the same idea, but it's, as opposed to looking at more direct, and in those direct calorimeters or room calorimeters, they're measuring literally everything that the subjects are, that's going in and out. So they're collecting like all the excrement and all that stuff too for those. So it's a bit more intense than what we do, but it's for like acute measurements of 20 to 30 minutes up to several hours. Like a morning would be a typical protocol for us. The indirect calorimeter is a good approach and is pretty much industry standard.
Sure. Yeah. Well, one question about this too, like you're talking about measuring metabolic rate. When we talk mm-hmm. about, you know, lay people talk about a person having a mm-hmm. slow metabolism or a fast metabolism or even speeding up someone's metabolism, is mm-hmm. the resting metabolic rate or the basal metabolic rate a good indicator of this? What we're talking about is somebody's metabolism overall? Or are they kind of two different concepts?
No, it's the same idea. I'm trying to think of, because when you start getting into how the terms are used in the general parlance, and particularly like on social media and so forth, mm-hmm. there's a bit of a disconnect. Like the fast and slow metabolism, I kind of, yes, there is heterogeneity in the population in metabolic rates. Mm-hmm. And you can do something to various things to alter metabolic rate within an individual. But we're talking really small effects, guys. We're talking, if we're talking about things like the application of this is a lot of times on like an individual level, like, oh, I'm having a hard time losing weight. Mm-hmm. I must have a slow metabolism.
Right.
Well, you might have a little bit of a slow metabolism, but you're also might be, well, let's also take a look at the whole picture here. And are you, do you have a slow metabolism coupled with excess consumption of sugar sweetened sodas that, you know, you're drinking 2 liters of soda per day. Mm-hmm. And so is it your slow metabolism or is it the soda? Right. You know, so that's where I really kind of hesitate, but yeah, there's the idea of looking at basal metabolic rate, and there's several ways to estimate this. You know, there's different fitness trackers or now devices that measure that claim to and do a reasonable job of monitoring things like recovery from exercise using heart rate variability indices and so forth.
Right.
They provide an estimate of metabolic rate, and my two cents on that is that they do a reasonable job. Even if they're not perfectly accurate, they serve as a useful tool to monitor progress over time, and just as a starting point. So it may say, one device may say that your basal metabolic rate is 1600 calories. Another one may say that it's 1800 calories per day. The truth may be 1700 calories per day. But truthfully, it doesn't really matter. What matters then is you start with that as a baseline and then match that with behavior to produce a desired change in one direction or another, gain weight, lose weight, maintain weight. And then take that iterative approach of using like kind of biofeedback, like, okay, I ate this amount that my food log tracker says I should produce some weight loss. I'm not losing weight, so I need to reduce my food intake, right? And then you can do that by measured amounts. But anyway, I may have gotten a little bit of off on a tangent from what you originally asked about the basal metabolic rate, because it's hard for me to uncouple the application of that. But the idea of using the basal metabolic rate or some estimate thereof as a starting point to pursue certain goals, absolutely. Do I think that there's a lot of people who have just an inherently slow metabolism? Not really. Absent something like a physician diagnosed hypothyroidism, most of us are more similar than we are different, I think.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And a lot of your current work in your lab at UGA is looking at the effects of exercise on postprandial fat oxidation. Can you talk a little bit about what you're looking at there? Is it really just oxidative stress, and why look at that?
Mm. Yeah, so that is where I do think we see the greatest potential for acute changes in this thing of metabolic flexibility. So the impact of exercise on basal metabolic rate is we can pick it up, we can measure it statistically significant. How clinically significant it is, it's not going to be enough to offset your, an extra candy bar or even like a single can of soda per day. However, what is kind of interesting is that the proportion of the energy burned at rest that comes from fat versus carbohydrate, that seems to be more amenable to change. And that concept has been around for a while. I mean, the early studies, and then it goes back earlier than this, but the kind of the modern era begins in the 1990s with a lot of studies looking at the effect of exercise on postprandial lipemia. So looking at the triglyceride response to a high fat meal. And I did some work in that area, linking it to some vascular outcomes in my doctoral, in my days at University of Maryland, where I was working on my doctorate degree, and have always been interested in that. And then carried on some of that work in the last few years here at UGA. But what we're finding is that not everybody likes to get a blood draw, number one, just practically. that requires an IV line that's placed, and you get multiple samples. And it's also, you're limited with how many blood samples you can get practically to about every 30 minutes at most, sometimes as little as single blood sample per hour. And then scientifically too, the triglyceride component is only one component. There's the other side, which is how much of that are you burning? And that's where this fat oxidation measurement comes in with the indirect calorimeter that we've been talking about. So it's that, why don't we look at this whole thing of, why don't we look at the other side and say, okay, how much of that fat are our participants in our experiments, how much fat are they burning using the indirect calorimeter? And maybe we can get a little bit more sensitive indicator of a response. And that's what we started doing. And in fact, our most recent paper on this showed that we can talk about the specifics. There's a lot to unpack here, but we looked at the effect of an acute high intensity functional training, i.e. a CrossFit style workout, on fat oxidation following a high fat meal that the participants had the next day. So the protocol is workout in the afternoon, go home, have a standardized meal that they eat on their own, come back in the lab fasted, and then do a high fat meal challenge. And what we saw with that was very interesting, that this fat oxidation measure was turned out to be more sensitive than the blood triglyceride marker. So the burning more fat, as indicated by indirect calorimetry, so greater fat oxidation area under the postprandial curve, but the triglyceride response, there was statistical noise in the data. It wasn't statistically significant, but we did pick it up with the fat oxidation. So the other, go ahead.
Oh yeah,
I see a question there.
No, I was just going to make sure I'm kind of wrapping my head around it correctly. So what you're looking at is you're saying, okay, in response to a meal. Or even at rest, you're saying if I measure the triglycerides in the blood and I'm looking for any sort of lowering or whether that's statistically not significant, but then I measure the output, which is then from the calorimeter, which you're measuring in the changes in the gases, you can sort of make an assumption of where the fat went ultimately. Is that kind of?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's the question of what are you doing with what you've ingested exactly? Yes. Where did it go? And the comparison is if they've had this high fat meal on a morning after a workout, more of it's being oxidized compared to having that same meal on a morning after a day when they were sedentary.
Right.
And right. Yeah, so and that kind of makes sense in my mind, because I think if you have more, if you're taking in more fat, you have more fat available, there's more available to be oxidized. Is that sort of what you're saying? But then what part of that is in training when you're losing fat that it becomes oxidized? So how do you tell the difference between the two? That's what you're talking about, what you're measuring.
That's a great question. Over time, if you're training and losing weight, we would need to like partition out the two. So this is, this would be like in a situation where like the study that we published that I'm referencing, that was healthy, trained, fairly lean, all young men. Okay. Right. So they can example of convenience at a university, how that is how that study worked out. We were able to look at the difference in fat oxidation in this very specific acute setting, sedentary versus trained. Over time, with a calorie deficit is what it would have to be. If we're talking about a weight loss study, with a calorie deficit, are we shifting the sort of the overall fat oxidation upwards? Not just, and I certainly think metabolic flexibility, which again, the ability to burn the fat that's ingested, which is what we're looking at with this kind of experiment. So not just the metabolic flexibility, but just overall shifting the physiological environment of the body to favor oxidation over storage. The calorie deficit is what helps with that, with like a weight loss. So that's a nutrition component as well. In addition to looking at using a meal as an acute physiological challenge, which is what we're, that's the phase we're at with this work, and certainly looking to move forward with like a weight loss type protocol. And that gets into like chronic adaptations, like changes in insulin sensitivity and ability to not just, so in these acute studies, these acute challenges, it's a really high fat meal, like a fat rich challenge. For something like what you're asking about, Patty, which I would be more interested in like a mixed meal challenge. It's more physiological, more relevant. And my cat Charlie has decided to make her presence, which she does every single time I'm on a Zoom call. Sorry.
Hi, Charlie.
I would use something more like a mixed meal challenge to look at not just the cook the fat in the meal, but also the carbohydrate in the meal. And if we want to get really sophisticated, which would require more funding and more sophisticated, more advanced lab measures, but we could get like radio labeled tracers to actually look at where, okay, how much of what's ingested is actually being consumed versus stored in the body, and partitioning into like glycogen replenishment following training, and tracking exactly where or how much is excreted in urine and so forth. That all gets really, really fascinating. That's we're talking about things like in my 5-year plan, you know, definitely the direction we want to go with some of this work. So,
Well, you mentioned this study was you were using high intensity interval training, something like CrossFit, look at fat oxidation and utilization. Have we compared that to other types of exercise like aerobic or anaerobic or things like that? You know, they always say historically it was always aerobic exercise.
Yeah, I mean, there's bias, right? There's a lot of bias in the literature because it's all aerobic.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. It's my favorite thing to rant and get on a soapbox about. So you guys, I know from the background info that you shared and the just the comments you made at the beginning that you guys have done your homework, and I appreciate that. So one of the things you may have come across, because it's one of our most recent publications, is a meta-analysis that we did that doctoral student Regis Pearson did on the effects of acute exercise on postprandial fat oxidation, the subject that we're talking about. And in that, so if your listeners are familiar with meta-analysis, it's a technique of reviewing the literature where you get a quantitative index of what is the effect of X on Y, whatever it is you're interested in, on, in our case, exercise, on whatever outcome that you're curious about, which in our case is this fat oxidation thing that we're discussing. And we did, it was really cool. He was taking a class, this is my doctoral student, was taking a class on meta-analysis. There's like the statistical approaches that you kind of need to become somewhat expert in, or at least proficient in, which I'm not, but he is now, on how to do it. And he was interested in this topic. So he, throughout the semester, he's in this class, pulled together all these papers and saying, hey, I think we can actually publish something on this and actually get this out there in the literature. And so he did that and arrived at an effect size, which is the measure of magnitude of the effect of exercise on postprandial fat oxidation, and found it to be about little over half a standard deviation, which means a moderate and probably clinically meaningful effect mm-hmm. of exercise on postprandial fat oxidation using these protocols that I'm describing. But that was fascinating. That was awesome. Interesting. So that by itself, I was like, okay, we can totally publish that. Mm-hmm. But then he looked at what's called a moderator analysis, which is, okay, how do we, in what context does this effect of exercise manifest? Which is, so what are the variables of the study population and maybe the experimental protocol that play into that effect?
Got it.
And that's where the really interesting stuff happened, which is when you say, okay, who are the subjects in these studies? And in whom is the effect of exercise most effective? Well, when we try to do that, we've ran into a problem, which is that, yes, there are significant moderator effects. So, for example, I don't have the data in front of me, but the most effective protocol is an endurance type protocol. The most effective, the study population where the effect is most pronounced is young men, like men under the age of 40 with a healthy BMI. Well, there's a huge caveat with that because it turns out that that's basically all that's been studied.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Right.
The number, if you look, and I wish I had in front of me, and I wish this was a visual thing because we have a great graph in that paper that really documents this, but
we'll
basically the bottom line is,
yeah,
if you can link it, that'd be awesome.
For sure.
The bottom line is the effect of exercise on postprandial fat oxidation has been largely studied in young, healthy men who are aerobically trained already and who are doing moderate intensity aerobic type exercise. Hmm. I mean, it's something like, I'm going to do some off the top of my head kind of rounding here, but like 75 to 80% of the data on this subject is in that kind of, like, so if we think of a section of a pie chart, that's about the section of the pie chart where all the data are for this question.
Wow.
So what's missing is studies in other populations, like women, like the other half of the population, older, slightly, I mean, not even that much older, like over 40, which is still quite a lot of people. And other exercise protocols, more than just the old school steady state cardio.
Right.
And so that's, so with our first study, we didn't address all of those things. We addressed one. We still studied the young, healthy men, sample of convenience.
Right.
Next step is to expand that. So we have plans for a study that I can talk a little bit about. It's currently being reviewed by the IRB. So wish us luck that we can get that approved in the next month or two. But it's looking at young versus older men and women now. So it's like a expand it from one group study to a four group study, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing where we wanted to start with that first experiment was let's look at something other than old school endurance type exercise. There's just been this love affair with the aerobic pathway as far as the exercise stimulus for health adaptations. But there's really a growing body of evidence that shows that maybe the glycolytic pathway might be important to activate during our workouts. That's the high intensity aspect, and get more than just the musculature of the quadriceps, like on a stationary cycling,
right.
a stationary cyclogrammeter, maybe like the other 80% of the muscle mass should be engaged as well. So that's where the functional training component comes in with like the CrossFit style protocol. So anyway, I told you it's a soapbox and a rant, so I might be a little bit circular, but we are definitely kind of, the cool thing about a meta-analysis like that is that it can give you like, okay, here's the landscape. And we can from there sort of plan a course of action, how you're going to navigate that landscape and kind of take it one thing at a time, or maybe a couple things at a time in different studies. So our first approach was to get into a little bit more functional and kind of more up-to-date exercise protocol, because everyone this is my big critique of our field, is that we're all kind of studying exercise in the same way all the time. Mm-hmm. We can have a little bit of room for innovation there. And then two, expand the study population and make this stuff a little bit more relevant for more people. And then three, get into chronic disease prevention and treatment, like into those pop. So right now we're in the prevention side. If we study this in younger, healthy people, then we're studying prevention. If you have somebody with established chronic disease, then that's a patient population, and that we need to do it all.
Right.
So.
Cool.
Well, to kind of extrapolate some of this back to, you know, some of the listeners who exercise or people who are trying to get into CrossFit or even any type of exercise, from the standpoint of like weight loss or improving metabolic health or metabolic flexibility, what's your recommendations around exercise and meal? Like, do you exercise before a meal or after a meal to kind of maximize the output and maximize the metabolic flexibility?
Yeah, both. I think so. In the nutrition recommendations are going to be obviously very individualized and custom. It depends on who they are and what the goal is. But for me, in my mind, if we're talking about general healthy population who does not need to necessarily restrict one macronutrient category. Okay, how about that? As a varied diet consisting of fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. The general idea is to cluster carbohydrate intake around training, because that's what's used in high intensity functional training. I mean, that is the glycolytic pathway is, if you're breathing hard and if your muscles are, you become aware of your muscles during your training, how about that? then that is a telltale sign that carbohydrate is the substrate. And it's by using that carbohydrate and by activating that glycolytic pathway that we produce this sort of myriad of adaptation that then allows for greater fat oxidation at rest. So it's like carbs, which you use for your workout, fat is what you use the rest of the time. Mm-hmm. That's really what we're going for with metabolic flexibility. You do not want to be, so somebody who's metabolically inflexible is burning carbs all the time. Mm-hmm. And even on something like when we get off this call, I'm going to carry this cat across the house and put her somewhere else. That I want that to be a fat burning activity for me. Right. I do not want that to be a carbohydrate, because that would be, it's a low level, a low threshold for a high intensity work. And we want to have fitness and power output, a work capacity that's provides us some reserve for daily activities like that, my goofy example. but as far as fueling, we want to cluster the textbook thing is roughly 60% of your daily carbohydrate intake around your training. So that'd be like before and after a meal. And then fats, we partition those further away from training. So if, like, if you train in the morning, which a lot of people do, not me, then you'd have more of your carbohydrate intake from the healthy carb sources. We're not talking simple, shrink wrapped packaged foods type carbs, but like your sweet potatoes and your, mm-hmm. Your whole grains and so forth. Those are around roughly 60% of your carb intake from those sources, around your training, and then fats partitioned further away from training, like in the evening, yep. if you train in the morning, and then protein, we want to keep that steady throughout the day. Yep. So that your muscles, since they're always kind of, recovering, repairing, growing, ideally growing a little bit, that we have a steady supply of amino acids throughout the day.
Yeah.
Great.
That's a little bit of my nutrition 101 lecture that I give at the university.
Yeah, it's great.
As it relates to exercise.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And it leads into a question and kind of a debate that I've heard out there, with the popularity of the ketogenic diet these days, mm-hmm. and the debate that goes on where essentially knowing what you said about exercise, especially high intensity being glycolytic, whether being on a ketogenic diet or being in ketosis might impact your ability to have, a positive or, full effect of the training. And so mm-hmm. I didn't know whether you had any sort of thoughts or stance on that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area, and it's something that I follow fairly closely. And my opinion is not short. So because it's nuanced, it's all dependent upon who we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So what I just said a minute ago was specifically, and I was fairly careful, I think, to qualify for the healthy population, somebody mm-hmm. who does not need a limitation on a particular macronutrient category. Mm-hmm. When we start getting into the chronic disease population, let's use type 2 diabetes, for example, or even pre-diabetes. Well, that's a disease of carbohydrate metabolism. And it's specifically of carbohydrate excess particularly in relation to the physical activity level. So too much supply, not enough demand. And so a first step in addressing that is to get those back in line. And the ketogenic diet is kind of the classic, now classic, the most sort of obvious way to do that. Mm-hmm. At the very least, like a reduction of carbohydrate, if not going to full-on ketosis. But absolutely, that's in order. And I don't think anybody with a basic understanding of physiology would argue with that, I don't think. I'll give you a good example. My parents, 2 or 3 years ago now, started a ketogenic diet and without really changing their physical activity very much and completely reversed their metabolic syndrome. They had been just diagnosed with metabolic syndrome from a functional medicine doctor mm-hmm. and said, this is what you need to do. And now 3 years later, that interesting thing about keto, this whole thing, is the sustainability is I think different for different people. My stepdad still loves it. He's on, yeah. Not looking back.
Yeah.
My mom's like, gosh, it'd be nice to get some like, if I just wanted to have, out to dinner and have some tortilla chips, can I not do that anymore for the rest of my life?
Right.
So that's where it kind of gets nuanced and individual. So what was the original question? Is my stance on,
just
particularly keto and exercise, that there's for the general population, my take on the, there's actually just a study that was published that I saw shared today. I don't know when it was published or recently, that shows it's really kind of at best neutral as far and maybe detrimental to high intensity exercise performance. So that's for, again, for the general population, who's again, using carbohydrate as fuel for high intensity work that doesn't have a disease of carbohydrate metabolism, keeping the main concern then becomes keeping calories, overall daily calories, with the appropriate macronutrient distribution optimized for fueling for performance and improve. So like for me, coming up on 4 years old, healthy body composition, trying to improve my fitness as long as I can until it starts. At some point, age is going to catch up and it's going to level up. I don't know when I'm going to stop hitting PRs. I haven't yet. So fingers crossed, but, I would not view that somebody like that meets my profile as a good candidate for like a pure ketogenic diet, because there's a mismatch of the fuel that's used for the training. But the studies they're still coming out on it. There's anecdotes and cases like, oh, well, this guy is, just set up to use the CrossFit, terminology lingo and talk about a workout. He just set a Fran PR and he's been keto for 5 years. Well, that's cool. Like that's what we have, but we have several cases of that, anecdotes of that. Mm-hmm. Based on the science, there's a mismatch between that kind of, metabolic demand and that diet, that the supply for that metabolic demand. Mm-hmm. For endurance athletes, there's a kind of more of an open question. We got to start to get into durations of exercise that are longer than the 5 to 15 minutes that are typical of a high intensity functional training protocol. We get into 60, 70, 92 minutes to 2 hours and longer. That's where you don't really have a whole lot of use for carbohydrates unless it comes down to a sprint finish at the end.
Right.
And it may, but that it's just less critical. Right. So again, there's debate on this. Yeah. And I think the debate when people, I've actually heard people like yelling at each other and calling each other names over this.
Oh yeah.
And I know you guys have too.
Right.
My opinion is that it's nuanced to the point that it's difficult to, unless somebody, the competing sides are really A, informed, and B, open, to have scientific discourse, that a lot of it gets lost. And that's, I think that's kind of where we're at, but
yeah.
I don't know. I hope I gave some semblance of an intelligent answer there.
I think that's super helpful. And laid out the different populations too. And I think what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, like as it relates to maybe somebody who is more metabolically flexible, more physically fit, and maybe even more in the frame of being an endurance athlete, not necessarily endurance athlete, but an athlete in general, having some carbohydrate around the time that they're expected to be training might be more beneficial to fueling the glycolytic pathway.
Absolutely. And then the other part of it too, is just like, I would take it so much on an individual basis, because again, like to my mom's example, I don't want to ever have to be limited. I don't want to be the guy at the party that has to bring my own food,
right.
Or only eat certain things or have nothing available because I didn't bring my own,
Right.
You always want to be, you got to consider some of this life stuff in choosing what's the optimal route when it comes to nutrition.
Right.
And I think that looks different for everybody, but one thing that's really popular, and I think you guys may have had some guests talking about this, is the carnivore diet pretty popular right now. Just only eat meat all the time.
Right.
There's part of me, I can kind of get behind that actually, just like I could actually maybe do that. And maybe I want to try it sometime, but if you're just so restricted, like what if you're at a friend's house and they're vegetarian? And that's what you have for dinner.
Right.
Like, I want to be able to make that work. Right.
Right. So, I do think it's much like everything we talk about on the show and in functional medicine. It depends. Always take the personalized approach. And Dr. Jenkins, we could talk about this for hours, but we are going to link to some of these studies in the show notes. But before we let you go, We do have one last question that I'm going to kick to Michael Chapman.
Yeah, we always
have
an off-topic question to catch you by surprise. And
I love it.
We call it the fireball.
I'm not prepared for this. Okay, fireball, hit me.
All right. Do you have a favorite wild animal?
And why?
I think tigers are the coolest animals ever.
Yeah.
I love dogs now, but I've always have a soft spot for cats. And then anytime I go to a zoo, which is maybe twice in the last 10 years, but I can't really explain why, but the tiger is just like, it's just so beautiful and it's amazing. And it's like, you can tell that if it wants to, it is a total badass. Can I say that on this podcast?
Yeah.
it can really do some damage, but it's also like very gentle. Just like, I don't know. I just love the tiger.
I sort of knew you were going to say that as soon as I saw your cat jump up. I was like, there's something about majestic about the cat, but still has a killer instinct.
Yeah, and I may have had the tiger on my mind because of that, but I don't know. I love all animals, actually. It's hard to pick one.
Oh, awesome answer. But again, Dr. Jenkins, we are so grateful that you came on the show. We're going to encourage all of our listeners to follow all the amazing work you're doing at the University of Georgia in the Integrative Cardiovascular Physiology Laboratory. And we're going to continue to follow all your publications in PubMed. And we're so grateful you came on the show, sir.
Yeah. Awesome conversation.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Take care.
That was awesome.
I could talk to him all afternoon. It's
Seriously.
Always fun talking to these PhD researchers because they have such a different take.
They totally come at it from a different angle,
yeah.
and they're so careful about clarifying exactly
yep.
their clinical claims, which I love.
That's what Dr. right. Jenkins does, and I loved it too. So much great information there.
Yeah, I've got a ton more questions. I think we should have him back on sometime. Like, I guess I should have asked this while he was here, but I love how he clarified the whole basal metabolic rate aspect
right.
and talked about that in a little bit more simplistic terms. Like, to me, it seems like where we should be going is this concept of metabolic flexibility rather than the way that we've been talking about, calories in, calories out, and basal metabolic rate.
Oh, yeah. This is the answer. This is the way of the future.
Next time on the Lab Report, Ralph Macchio. I know a guy. I'm going to get him.
You've been listening to The Lab Report. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast, rate us, and leave us a review. To learn more about Genova Diagnostics, visit our website at gdx.net. There you'll find information on specific testing, educational resources, and how to connect with our show. Call us at 1-800-522-4762 or email us at podcast@gdx.net.
Okay, let's hypothetically say Ralph Macchio comes on,
uh-huh.
Danny LaRusso.
Yeah.
What would you ask him? Just about the Karate Kid, or is he in other things, or what would you want to know?
I would want to know what Mr. Miyagi was like offset.
Oh, come on.
Seriously.
Like, do you think he's just like catching flies with chopsticks all day?
Yeah, like, did he have 37 bonsai trees in his trailer?
Was Ralph Macchio in any other movie besides Karate Kid?
I don't know.
Name one thing he was in other than the Karate Kid.
Karate Kid 2 and 3.